Hello, hello, and welcome back again to Culture Cryptids.
That's right. We are here again to hopefully amuse you, maybe educate you. Probably not. I'm not going to get our hopes up for that.
It's called edutainment, and it is a valid word and a valid thing.
I'm
So,
sorry. I'm sorry. Edutainment, then.
edutainment.
I'll go with that.
Before we get too deep into what we are going to talk about, I need to know, because we've not had a chance to discuss it yet. I need your feelings on Dune 2 Electric Boogaloo.
I really feel like I need another glass of wine for this, but just hit me with that one. Overall, I actually really liked Dune 2. I will preface this with saying, like, I have read, I think, the first two books in the series. I know a lot about them, and I have seen the other adaptations. So I do really like Dune. I feel like for the first time, and I hate to say this, that a director actually understood the assignment when adapting Dune, if that makes sense.
Yes.
This is not a spoiler, but Paul Atreides is not the hero of this story. And finally, like, I think someone's gotten that.
The glaring, I don't know, this is a perfect example and exercise about how media literacy doesn't exist anymore.
Well, you say that, but the literal worst person I ever dated, their hero was like Paul Atreides. And I see the look on your face, and you're right. You can judge me for that. I was young. I
No,
didn't know better.
but here's the thing. If you look back at like the 1984 Dune, David Lynch's Dune, it is a very different movie. And if that
Yes.
was your only if that was your only
It was not.
exposure to the
I'm gonna
character,
pause you right there. It was not. They'd read all the books. So, yeah.
yeah, it paints a different story and different picture. The only thing that, I mean, I enjoy that movie. I went and saw it in the theater when they did the like Fathom event where they did the 40th anniversary showing of it. It has a special place in my heart, but it is trash and the movie is ridiculous. And the best part of it is little Alia, like
Oh,
little
yeah.
Alicia Witt, you
Yeah.
know. I think Denis did a great job. And what's been really fun is trying to explain the lore and mythology behind Dune to teenagers who have also seen this movie now, the teenagers that ran my life. That's been a real treat for me.
I do think that, like, if you read Dune, the first book, like, it is more of a philosophy book than it is a whole lot of other things. And I do think that if you have not read the book and you've seen the film and you have questions, I do highly recommend going back and reading the first Dune book. I need to go back and reread it myself, having now watched Dune 2. I really love what they did with a lot of the stuff in it and the way they hit home some of this idea of propaganda, the way they, like, I fanatic Stilgar was not something that I thought I was going to see, and I thought it was great. But, like, Javier Bardem does a great job no matter what he's doing, so it's
Oh,
fine.
a real treat, a real real
Yeah,
treat.
giving Chani a voice and an arc was fabulous.
And using her as the device to really just hammer it home for you that Paul is not the hero of this story.
I loved it. I really thought it was great. I love the ending. No spoilers if you haven't seen it. I will say they changed some things, but I'm not mad about the changes. I think the changes may make it harder to adapt the second book if they decide to, but I would watch it if it was the same director and the same cast.
Well, it is. I think it's already been greenlit. I
Oh,
think
is
that
has
it,
it? I
yeah.
didn't know. But yeah,
I think Denis got everything, I think, ready to go too.
if he comes back and directs it, like, I will watch the next series. No, I mean, I would probably watch it anyway just to see, but I'm on board with whatever he wants to do with this now.
I think everybody acting wise really knocked it out of the park. I will be shocked if Timothy does not get some sort of nomination for it. Rebecca Ferguson, I have had a crush on for years now, and this just made my crush on her even larger.
Oh, yeah, she's incredible. But everybody in this movie, I think, was just fabulous. So many good moments, so many good character moments, especially from the book that you got to see. I was really skeptical, I'll be honest with you, really skeptical of, like, Austin Butler.
Yes.
But his fade, I was like, all right. All right, because I mean, I knew Batista was gonna be great. I knew he was gonna be a good Raban, but Austin Butler was, yeah, fantastic. Just
that whole sequence on Gaedia Prime was really, I really, really enjoyed that.
Yeah, yeah, I think they did a really good job with the characterization based on what we get in the novels to now. I really think that Florence Pugh, they gave her, because she's that character. The princess Irulan, I always can never pronounce her name. She is not really in the first book. You see her writing, like, because she's the chapter headers.
Right.
But you don't meet her in the first book. And I really like the way they kind of combined her and another character to give you more, and in a good way, in a really good way.
I think that my favorite Letterboxd review that I've seen of the movie is that the film is a cautionary tale about how mothers shouldn't tell their sons that they're special. And it was all, like, yeah.
All the discourse about boy moms. Yeah, definitely.
Well, we could go on and on about Dune, but that is not what we are here to talk about today.
That's right. That is not the topic of our show today.
So we are in spring. Spring has sprung. What are we going to talk about? How are we going to welcome in the spring?
Well, I thought we'd go back to some fun folklore for everybody, and we're going to talk about fairies.
Fairies.
Yes, it's a weird way of saying it, but okay.
Yeah, don't ask me what that accent was supposed to be. I cannot tell you.
It sure was a thing, though.
But yeah, fairies, fae, fairy with an R-Y, fairy with an A-E. Fair folk, all of it. Yeah, that's what we're going to talk about.
I'm sorry. I thought it would be, we thought it would be a fun thing to kind of talk about some of the original aspect of the fae, I guess, as it were.
Yeah, I think it's just kind of, we had talked about doing kind of some episodes where it's my favorite monster. And I love that, like, our first My Favorite Monster episode isn't really about monsters. It's about fairies.
Okay. Your mileage may vary there, but the fae are very monstrous.
Yeah. You're right.
I think that's kind of what we're kind of getting into here, is when we talk about some of our favorite creatures from this aspect of folklore, is kind of how monstrous they can be.
Well, what got you into fairies? What was, like, your first exposure to fairies in media?
So in media specifically? Mm-hmm. Probably Legend, I'll be honest with you. The 1980s film with baby Tom Cruise and Tim Curry as the Darkness, who we have already established was one of those
fuckable monsters.
Core memories for me. Yes. Yeah, that kind of, I think, sparked some of my interest, because it was dark fantasy in a way that Disney didn't do, in a way that a lot of other kids' media was not doing at the time. You had that, a lot of elements of that. Even though you had, like, a few, like, pixies in it, you also had a lot of darker stuff.
Right.
So that might have been my first. That was before I got into actual folklore, which came from a... You know how they have those Overstock books? Books a Million is a very popular bookstore in the South. And they have all those Overstock books where they've made too many copies of something and sell it to you for, like, $5.
Uh-huh.
When I was, like, in, I think, the fourth grade, I'd already had this big interest in folklore. And my mom bought me this $6 book that was a giant oversized coffee table book of Greek, Norse, and Celtic folklore. It was like an encyclopedia. And I read that thing from cover to cover so many times that the cover fell off of this giant hardback book. I was enamored of it. So
that tracks.
Yeah, it tracks. Does, doesn't it? Yeah. What about you?
I think mine was Labyrinth.
Mm. Yeah.
So kind of in the same vein as yours with Legend, around that same time period, it was a very impactful experience. That was the first movie that I ever saw in the theater as a little kid.
And I think that really makes a lot of sense, considering Labyrinth was kind of developed by a member of Monty Python and the most delightful artist, Brian Froud.
Yes, as I sit here and have my Brian
Froud. Oh, Good Fairies and Bad Fairies. I have that book. Yeah, Brian Froud was very seminal in my understanding of fairy folklore in general, as he did Good Fairies, Bad Fairies, Lady Coddington's Book of Pressed Fairies. Did you have that one? And then like an Encyclopedia of Fairies, he also did. And he's a delightful artist. You should look at some of his work online, which is also fun because he and his wife both are very big into folklore and into fairies specifically. And because he did the book in the 70s just called Fairies with like Alan Lee, who was an illustrator who worked a lot with Tolkien. Like the two of them did that big book on fairies and Tolkien stuff.
I had that book as well. I do not know what happened to it.
Yeah, I actually can't find my copy either.
Maybe the fairies took it.
Maybe they did. Brian Froud's wife, Wendy, is also a big, and she is like a puppetry person too, surprising nobody. And they met while working on The Dark Crystal and then later worked on Labyrinth, weirdly enough.
All those Jim Henson folks.
Yeah, she also really liked likes a lot of bunch of like different creature features and stuff, and they've worked together on a bunch of like cute folklore things together. That was one of my big things, I think, was reading Brian Froud's, just all of his work on fairies.
That actual copy of the Good Fairies, Bad Fairies book that I have was a gift from a boy when I was in high school.
Aww. My copy is, it sounds like I'm bragging, is signed by Brian Froud. I met him when I was in high school. He came to a convention and I was like, I think 13 or 14, and I lost my mind over it. Like, I need you to know, like, I was like, oh my God, Brian Froud is here. Did you know Brian Froud is here? I don't know what I'm going to do. And it has one of his little,
that
like,
also tracks.
Yeah, it tracks. Like, anytime I'm just like, oh my God, like, it's, I don't really like get that big about meeting celebrities, but like, you put like an artist or a writer, and I'm like, oh my God, they created this thing. Did you know that they did this thing? And I completely lose my mind over it. It's fine. I'm perfectly normal, I swear. So I think both of us got into folklore, and specifically like fairy folklore, pretty early on. And it's interesting that we're talking about it now because it's having a resurgence. Like, the fairies in general are having this kind of interesting popular culture resurgence, but it's not in film. It's in like fantasy novels.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I will tell you that and I'm going to drop it here. Yes, I have read all the Sarah J. Maas books. I've been there. I've read her books since she was like publishing them when I worked at a bookstore a million years ago. Yeah, I've read The Fairy Smut. I know about The Fairy Smut. I'm here for it. But
shockingly, I do not have a whole lot of exposure or experience with Fairy Smut because as a queer man, it was much more about vampires and werewolves for me, which I know that you are a fan of werewolves as well.
Yeah, but... yeah. I mean, I read a lot of fairy stuff. It's only been in the last couple of years I've been able to find some good, like, queer fairy fiction, which I've been very pleased about finding too, because it is a little harder to find stuff that kind of matches everybody's interests and tastes. But yeah, I have read a lot of fairies in popular culture. The very popular Dresden Files deals a lot with fairy and folklore. And while, of course, all of these things have a fantasy bent to them, I think the Dresden Files does a pretty decent job of like at least touching on some of the folklore aspects of stuff. Getting started in this topic, I think one of the big things that we first have to address is sort of, when we think about fairies, what do people normally think of? Not you or I.
Yeah, not us, but I mean, I think people generally think of things like Tinkerbell.
Yeah.
I do think that in popular culture, especially now with the resurgence, that people do think a little bit more about the dark elements of the fae, especially when you think of things like True Blood, you know, that had some fairy elements to it. So it's not all sunshine and lollipops with them anymore.
Right. I do think we're seeing more of kind of the darker elements of fairy folklore come back into style now, which is fascinating considering so many of these stories kept so many people, like so many of our ancestors, up at night worried about these things in a way that we're telling smutty stories about now. Yeah, it's kind of like people don't realize that hundreds of years ago, people were very concerned about these creatures that they thought they shared their land with. Like they thought that these creatures were on the land with them, they were sharing with them, and that offending them could lead to like really life-changing and sometimes like dire consequences.
I think like, yeah, even in the modern age, like if you look at like Iceland, for instance, which is, you know, a very modern country.
Oh, yeah.
The majority of the population there believes in the existence of fairies and elves, and they take those things into consideration when they do public projects and things. Like if they're building roads, they take those things into account. Where like, no, you can't build there. Fairies live there.
They really do. They're very, in some level, it's a very interesting form of like conservation, because it is very much like, no, this doesn't belong to us. This land is not ours to do with what we want. It, like, something older than us lives there. And I think that's really fascinating because these people, there's a lot of people that wouldn't say they're superstitious that still are like, no, the little, they call them like little folk or whatever the translation is. I'm not sure about the actual word, but like, no, they live there. The elves live there. We can't go there. And I think when we think of elves, we often think of like Santa's little helpers or things like that. But when they think of elves, that's not really altogether what they're thinking of. So if you are not familiar with folklore at all, or like anything to do with it, we thought it might be good if we talked a little bit about kind of like a brief overview of the Fae of the British Isles, because that is where a lot of this stuff kind of culminated in, or like began, has its roots in. So yeah, so like most of the time when we're talking in modern folklore discussion, like especially in popular culture, especially in urban fantasy, is a mixture of like Norse, Scottish, and British influence. And I say British, I mean British Isles. Like I'm not just talking about the like UK in general. I'm talking about like all the countries there. So that can lead to a lot of contradictions, because all of these are very distinct cultures, and also kind of like contradictions in behavior and contradictions in appearances too. So what we're talking about may not be what you've heard growing up, because these are a lot of variations and differences. So there's a lot of regional stories, regional things. Many times they were called the good neighbors, and they were known to live in forests and in the mounds, and all of these fairy mounds, which we'll talk about. So for the Irish, they were known as the Sidhe or the Fianna Sidhe, and the Fianna Sidhe is specifically the descendants of the Tuatha De Danann, which are the people of the goddess Danu, which you're going to talk about a little bit more. So
a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But that was an ancient goddess that is pre-Christian times. And for the Welsh, and I'm going to tell you right now, I do not speak Welsh.
I'm ready for this. I'm
doing my best here. I'm trying. They were called the Tylwythteg. And I believe that is how you pronounce that. If I don't, someone can yell at me. I have practiced pronunciation so many times, and I'm still going to get it wrong. I'm really trying. And both of these kind of are closer to, and I always tell people when they're talking about fairies, closer to Tolkien's elves than pixies or Tinkerbell that we think of today. Because Tolkien was very inspired by these old folklore stories, right?
Yeah, I know that for the couple that I'm going to talk about, neither of them have that classic look of, you know, being sprite-ish and having wings. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I don't think any of the things we talk about today are going to fall in that like real categories. So most of what we consider like fairy folklore today is based off the writing of like one person. And there are a couple sources in here that I've used, but one of them is the main one. And that's like Nobel Prize winner and famous poet, William Butler Yeats. And Yeats wrote a book called Irish Fairy and Folk Tales in 1888. Okay. And this was like kind of a collection of stories that he had discovered or had talked to. And he put them all together. And this is kind of the basis for our modern understanding of what was going on back then. Yeats is really interesting because he had this like interest in occultism, and he belonged to this organization called the Golden Dawn, which is the secret organization that supposedly practiced ritual magic. So he was like, I'm going to go ahead and say it. He sounds like a little bit of a weirdo. Like I read a book about him. I was like, all right, sir, I see where you're coming from. But his work is very important because it takes into account pre-Christian traditions. Because again, a lot of what we know today is tempered by Christianity, and Christians have a different understanding of fae than was like pre-Christian traditions. So Yeats kind of organizes the Fae into different categories. And the categories that he uses are trooping Fae and solitary Fae, which is basically how he sets them up in terms. Trooping Fae are kind of what you would consider the quote unquote like courts. They come together, they hang out together. A lot of times you may find them in a group versus like solitary Fae that are just one-offs that you may find out there causing, and either can either cause you mischief or be kind to you. That he never kind of made that distinction between those. The most common distinction of sort of what like people talk about today are these ideas of like quote unquote courts. And that's been kind of like a recently popularized in folklore. You'll see it a lot in fiction where they talk about the two courts. And that kind of comes from the Scottish sectioning on there. And like court for them doesn't necessarily mean super organized with like king and queen and like all these different ranks. It's just how they organize them. And we see all that in Scottish myths and in like the 1800s as well. And that's of course the seely and the unseely. And the differences are of course the whether they were helpful towards humans, which are the seely, or unhelpful towards humans, which are the unseely. However, you can still piss off seely Fae and ruin your life. Like that's not a necessary thing.
That is something I think that is consistent across any type of Fae is fickle. They are fickle. And
oh yeah, for sure. So that kind of gives you a very basic overview of specifically the British Isles and how they kind of looked at things. Do you think there's anything I was missing there? Anything you'd like to add?
No, I think that's a good foundation for anybody. Yeah.
Yeah. We are simplifying things. I want that to be very clear. I understand that we are simplifying things.
We are but a humble horror podcast. We are simplifying things. This is not a huge scholarly discussion.
I just want to talk about cool stuff, okay?
But you do sound knowledgeable. Again, you are the academic among the two of us. So, and it definitely shows.
I did too much research. And like, again, the Irish Yeats's book is quite helpful. There's another book that I'm going to link to that you can get a copy of digitally. Kindle has it digitally, but it's really impossible to find a hardcover of. And that's Catherine Mary Briggs's An Encyclopedia of Fairies. She's done a great job in that. Like, I think the last copy I could find was like from the 70s, and it's like every copy used, even on thrift books, was like $100 and something. And I was like, I don't have that money. I would love a copy of that book, but now it's digital. So I found a, cause it is out of print. So I will link a couple sources that have a really good like archive of some of them and where you can get kind of find some of her stuff.
So I think that we each picked a couple that we wanted to kind of touch on in this episode. I think it goes without saying that we're going to come back to the topic of Fae.
Oh, yeah.
A few times.
I will talk about them forever.
So this is just kind of a little amuse-bouche of getting into the topic.
And as a note, there are, in fact, no folklore horses involved here. I have very purposefully did not mention them here, but I want you to know that several almost made it onto my list, but then I realized that would be a whole episode in themselves. So I didn't put
them. I need you to lean in just a little bit. Lean in just a little bit. I have a folklore horse.
I know. I know you did.
Okay. Should I get us kicked off? Should I start this party off?
Where are you starting us off? What did you pick?
So the first one I picked was Black Annis. Are you familiar with Black Annis?
I am, yes. In the vague, I am familiar with what Black Annis is.
Yes, Black Annis, the blue-faced hag, also known as Black Agnes or Black Anna. And I think a good way to start this off is actually, I'm going to go to the Good Fairies, Bad Fairies book by Brian Froud. And I'm going to read the entry here for Black Annis. There is a chill wind blowing. Bolt your windows and bar the door, for Black Annis is about. This highly dangerous fairy hag grabs children through open windows and takes them back to her lair to devour them. When horrid Black Annis is hungry, her howls can be heard for miles.
Ooh.
And it has a very, if listeners, if you have not seen this book, it is worth, if nothing else, the art in it is gorgeous and beautiful.
It's a beautiful book, yeah.
It's a beautiful book. So Black Annis is a boogeyman figure in English folklore. And as it says in there, she's imagined as a blue-faced hag with iron claws and a taste for human flesh, especially children. And she's said to haunt the countryside of Leicestershire, living in a cave in the Dane Hills with a great oak tree at the entrance. So that gives us a good understanding of who this fae be. So what's her thing? Like, what makes what distinguishes her from other fae, especially other scary fae? So I've got a list here for you.
Okay, here we go. This is our first list.
This is our first list. It is actually, I have more than one, so apologies in advance. So Black Annis, about her, she loves to hit the town at night looking for unlucky kids and lambs to eat.
Okay.
She's also a big fashion maven because after she eats these kids, she tans their skin by hanging on a tree, and then she wears it as a sassy little skirt.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we love a sustainable queen.
Yes.
She's got them long arms, so she does like to reach inside folks' house to snatch them up. And for fun fact, it's said that the cottages in this area were purposely built with small windows so she could only get a single arm inside.
I mean, if you know that someone's going to try to grabber you in the middle of this.
Did you say grabber you?
Yes, I did.
Love it, love it. She's a fan of a good scare because she likes to hide in the branches of the aforementioned oak tree and jump on unsuspecting prey. And you may think that because she's into fashion that she'd be girly, but you'd be wrong.
Oh, okay.
This DIY queen used her own iron claws to dig her cave out of the cliff, making it into a home commonly known as Black Annis's Bower Close.
Okay.
And to that I have to say, I love all of the different words that the English have for like houses and land and places. like I don't live, my house is down the street. No, come down to my Bower Close. And some traditions do have her grounding her teeth or howling so that these cottagers could have time to shore up their homes and keep themselves safe. It is said that you could hear her howl for 5 miles.
Oh, okay. So she's a screamer. Got it. All right.
She's a screamer. So let's get into like where she came from, like what the origins of Black Annis are. So the earliest written reference is from an 18th century title deed that referred to a parcel of land, or a close, if you will, as Black Annie's Bower Close. The first volume of County Folklore from 1895, that's the publication by the Folklore Society, mentions two such title deeds dated May 13th and 14th, 1764.
Okay.
So that's our first written reference. But let's go and think about what could have inspired this particular creature, this particular hag, this particular fae. So you brought up earlier Celtic traditions and Celtic mythology, and specifically Danu. So that is a tie that possibly where Black Annis could have come from is Danu or Anu, which that goddess is associated with motherhood and agricultural prosperity.
Okay.
If we look in Germanic and Norse mythology, she could have been pulled from Hel, which, as we know, is Cate Blanchett from that one Thor movie.
Okay.
The goddess of death. It could be pulled from Kali, which is the Hindu goddess associated with times, doomsday, and death.
Mm-hmm.
And could have been pulled from Demeter, the Greek goddess of the harvest and agriculture, also of health, birth, and marriage. But she does have some parallels and some ties also possibly to Isis, Hathor, and Neith, which are Egyptian creation deities. So the common theme with all of these are that there's like a motherhood aspect, a creation aspect, sometimes a death aspect. So we might be wondering like why there's the part of her about her eating children. And that has to do with a lot of times mother goddesses in any pantheon are thought to be like devourers of children, mainly because if people were offering up sacrifices to these gods and goddesses, a lot of the times it was innocent lives or children.
Which makes sense because sacrifices are always supposed to be like innocent, I guess.
Yes, yeah. Yes. But there are some individuals who are like, no, it's not tied to that. That it is actually tied to a person by the name of Agnes Scott.
Okay.
So a real individual who could have been either a medieval anchoress, which is not a lover of anchors. It's kind of like a hermit, like a hermetic lifestyle, but you kind of stay in one place. Or she may have been a Dominican nun who cared for a local leper colony. So she was born in Little Antrim, and she lived a life of prayer in the cave in the Dane Hills. That's where she resided. So that's where we get kind of the Black Annis and the Bower Close in that area. Where she may have been, like, the story of her may have been twisted into kind of this, you know, dark visage of Black Annis, is just kind of like naturally what happens over time, where people want to scare their children. They'll take a story and kind of twist it a little bit. Or what's really interesting is that it could have been intentional, because of anti-Incret sentiment that arose from the Protestant Reformation in England.
Okay. Yeah. If you need to prosecute somebody, you just go for the religious prosecution somehow. Turn them into a monster. It's the easiest way to do it.
Turn them into a monster. Yeah. There aren't a whole lot of customs that are associated with this particular fae. In some stories, she is depicted as having like cat-like appearance or cat-like features. So in early spring, they would take a dead cat, usually drenched in anise seed. So that's where we kind of get the anise from.
Okay.
And it would be dragged before a pack of dogs in front of her bower to celebrate the end of winter. But this was a custom and a practice that died out at the end of the 18th century.
I mean, good.
Ooh. Yeah, yeah.
It's gruesome. I think that's interesting, because I think I had always heard of her in the same context of the, like, the drowning fae, like the fae that would come and drown you. But it doesn't seem like she has all that much in common with them. So that's kind of interesting. That's the context that I learned about her in.
Yeah, like more in kind of like the in line with like a, was it Jenny, like Jenny Green Teeth?
Or like Peg Prowler. Like,
or Peg Prowler, yeah.
Creatures like that, but it turns out like she's incredibly distinct from that.
Yes, yes. She's a cave witch.
Okay, yeah. You do like cave witches.
I do like cave witches.
Okay, yeah, I had known about her a little bit, but I didn't know all the specifics of her. So that's really fun to find out.
Yeah, I enjoy it, especially ones that kind of can be a little murky in their origins, where there could be a few possible different sources of where they spring forth from. I also, like, I know you are too, like, I'm a huge fan of anything that parallels a creature or an entity from another culture's mythology or another pantheon. I especially love having those examples whenever. Nothing against Christianity, but I love to tell people, like, Christianity is its own mythology. It is mythology like anything else, like Greek mythology, especially when you can draw parallels between, like, oh, you know, this story in the Bible.
It has its own fan fiction that people like. Yeah. Canon. And I say this because Dante's Inferno was fan fiction, friends. I will not go on a rant here, but I have one. When people start talking crap about, like, fan fiction, I'm like, oh, you mean like Dante's Inferno? And they're like, wait, what? And I'm like, Paradise Lost. Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about those. But anyway, that's, yeah. It is interesting that you have a bunch of parallels for all these different cultures. Like, Polly specifically is an interesting kind of parallel to that I had never thought of.
Yeah, you wouldn't think that, you know, this creature that resides in the British Isles would have possible roots in a Hindu goddess, a Greek goddess, or even, like, it's something, you know, entities from the Egyptian pantheon.
Yeah it's kind of an interesting way that we can track some common motifs, I would say, through different cultures.
But that is everything that you would need to know, a good primer on Black Annis.
All right. Well, speaking of loud ladies, I guess, if that's what the thing is here, I actually wanted to talk about a fairy type that I believe it gets mentioned a lot, but I think not a lot of people understand the full, like, cultural context for them. And that is, of course, the Banshee. And because you see them a lot in popular culture, like, there's like super villains named after them. And, like, you know, we talk about a lot about, like, screaming like a Banshee, but that's, of course, like, what most people know about them. I have always kind of felt really fascinated by them because they're psychopomps, basically, in that they herald death in a way that is such an interesting kind of folklore aspect that we don't talk about enough. So a banshee is often found in Irish and Scottish folklore, almost specifically in those two. You don't see them mentioned much out of that. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, she is a woman who has long hair and a gray cloak, usually over a green dress. The green dress is something that comes up a lot in these stories. her eyes are always red. And while some people have interpreted that as being like, oh, her eyes are glowing red and evil, it's usually because she's been crying a lot. Like, her eyes are red from crying. So there's different interpretations whether or not she has glowing red eyes or it's just around her eyes are red for that.
Bloodshot. Yeah.
Yeah, bloodshot from like the weeping that she's doing. Because banshees are, of course, known for their wails, their cries. And they are, if you hear a banshee cry, it foretells someone's death. And if you hear many of them together, it is thought that they're heralding the coming death of like a prominent person. So one banshee can mean just someone is dying. The other, like a bunch of them together, means that someone really important is about
like
to
royalty,
pass away. Like or royalty something like or something like that. Yeah.
Like Kate Middleton or the King of England or something like that.
Sorry, you didn't mention that for any particular reason or anything. But yeah, yeah. Like that, like that, someone important, a lord or lady of the land. There are some differences between the Scottish banshee and the Irish banshee, though, because the Scottish banshee is considered hideous, right? And I say that because they're talked about how they only have one nostril. They have protruding front teeth, specifically maybe only one tooth, and long hanging breasts. And I don't know why this was specifically mentioned, but this is something that's mentioned in a lot of the stories. So they are hags in a way, like fall under that distinction of being hags, which are considered ugly and unattractive.
Yeah, I feel like saggy breasts are a common motif in a lot of these creatures.
It's a weird thing to bring up, but yeah, in Scotland, that's a thing. By comparison, Irish banshees are said to be lovely because they'll take the form of young women, young virgins specifically. They often have red or silver hair, depending on the story. And they do also have that long cloak that they wear as well.
Do they usually in the face covered too, right? Or is that?
They have like, yeah, if they're wearing a cloak, their faces are cloaked, but they're young women, not older women. So you have
That's the version that I'm used to is the beautiful.
The beautiful, yeah. That's specifically the Irish version that comes from, which is weirdly enough, I think it comes from, there's a couple sources for this. And one is, Lady Wilde, who Anne Wilde was, and she lived from 1821 to 1896. And that is, of course, Oscar Wilde's mother was a folklorist, and she talked about the Irish banshees and made sure to mention that they were pretty. And like, she's actually, honestly, she did a ton of research into Irish folklore at the time too. So she's a big proponent of it. And her book, like she talks a lot about them and makes sure she says that they describe her height, state the banshee stature is short, anywhere between 1 foot and 4 feet. Her exceptional shortness often goes alongside the description of her as an old woman, though it may also be intended to emphasize her state as a fairy creature. And then she goes on to say, like, sometimes the banshee assumes the form of some sweet singing virgin of the family who died young and has been given the mission by the invisible powers to become the harbinger of coming doom to her mortal kindred. So we kind of see these different interpretations of what they are and what they look like. Now, here's where it gets kind of interesting in folklore, because there's different things. Some legends say that each family has their own banshee, and the banshee will wail just for that family and that family alone. So if you hear the banshee wail, it is
wailing. It has to do with your family.
It has to do specifically with your family. However, like Sir Walter Scott, in some of his work, put together this theory that the banshees only cry in the deaths of certain families. Specifically, families that are considered like surnames that start with either O or Mac, which are very obviously traditional, like, you know, Scottish surnames.
Right.
And they go on to mention a couple that they like some folklores, there's only 7 families, some that are only 6. And the 6 that I found mentioned were like the O'Neills, O'Connors, O'Briens, Kavanaughs, and the O'Grady's. So you have a little bit of variation considering where you are. Is that your banshee? Don't know. It could be yours. Could just be one of the families. Maybe you're not important or rich enough to have your own banshee.
You don't have your own banshee. Oh.
Oh, who are you? Where are you from? Yeah. So they also, instead of just wailing for those families, they may also wail at the deaths of people who were especially musically talented. If you were a renowned singer or were really good at an instrument, they may wail for your death too. So that is some folklore stories. Of course, the word banshee, the way it's spelled traditionally and the way that it actually is spelled in the stories are a little different. Because again, it has that she in it, which refers to the Irish fae themselves.
Right.
And not just, yeah, the, that's where it comes from. And it means woman of the mound. It, they also can go by other names, depending on where you are, which of course, hag of the mist, which is obviously Scottish, little washerwoman, and hag of the blackhead. And little washerwoman is important because it is referred to as the badney, which is a Scottish variant in the same motif. In her case, she's always a washerwoman. You will find her only along the banks of a river or a pond or some body of water where she is washing blood from clothing. And the clothing is specifically of the person who's about to die. So if you see a woman washing blood off of some arbor, someone died in battle. If you like some clothing, it is clearly linked to the person in question. So obviously, if you see some woman washing your loved one's clothing, it does not mean she's having an affair with them.
No.
She is, in fact,
they're going to die.
Yeah. And specifically, the Benny foretells a violent death. So either in battle or some sort of betrayal or something like that. Violent deaths only. It's really important to note that something I think that gets lost in modern retellings of the story is that banshees don't cause death. They only foretell it. Because I think that's... go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's always been my understanding. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that they didn't cause it. It was just, yeah, a harbinger. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think a lot of times in popular culture, you see the idea that their screaming causes you to die. Like you hear it, like it's a siren song and you're going to die. And not that it's just telling you that your time is here. It's out of your hands, but they're not the cause of it. So that kind of gets us an interesting thing is like, where do they come from? Like, why are they a thing? And do you know anything about the Keeners?
I do not.
Yeah. I didn't either. So I think this is really fun. The Keeners are a much like an old tradition dating back to about the 8th century. And in that time, women would be chosen, usually probably paid to do it, to wail and cry at funerals. You have these women.
I think I have heard of this.
Yeah, these women that would come to funerals and cry over the dead and grieve loudly. They would sing sad songs and they would just weep to mourn the dead person. And they would do it so loudly that it would be heard throughout the village or whatever in the area could hear them. So that everyone would hear them, everyone would know that this person had died. And I had this impression, and this is something that I need to like do a little bit of research with. I have this impression that they were probably paid for like wealthy families to show up and be very sad.
Yeah. Or just to make it seem like that person was more important, which I think is interesting because I feel like that goes hand in hand with the whole idea of every family having its own banshee.
Yeah, that seems to fit with that story. And I don't know that that's true or not. But I think that you can probably tie this tradition to this idea of a woman crying for you. So maybe these stories kind of rose from people seeing all these women weeping over these things. And we have written records of banshees from the 1600s. There is, what's her name? Lady Anne Fanshawe. I don't remember. She did in her memoir, she writes about the sighting of a banshee. So, and that was the mid 1600s. So we have some like context for them going back at least that far. And that is the one of my favorite harbingers of death. There are multiple ones.
That's just one of my tops.
Yes, yes.
Banshees are something that I think the amount of them we do see in popular culture is very interesting to me and all of the different takes we see on it. Cause I'm trying to think of like ones I've seen recently. And the most recent one I could think of is from the most recent season of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, because they go to the UK and there is a particular storyline where they believe Dee to be a banshee.
Okay. God, that is, I have not seen that season. I'm a little behind in Always Sunny, but that's pretty great. But of course, they also say the D is an ostrich. So
Yeah, D is a bird. D is a bird. Yeah.
Yeah, D is a bird. So I guess Banshee fits right in there. Yeah, I'm trying to think of some more modern interpretation of banshees in popular culture that this would build from. But for the most part, you know, you do see her today as like, I think one of the culturally the Yoyorina. Did I say that correctly? I did not say that correctly, did I? The weeping woman, the crying woman, the vengeful ghost from Mexico.
Oh, La Llorona?
Yeah, Llorona. Like that is another kind of weeping woman found near a body of water, which is kind of an interesting spirit to see in both so far away from each other.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Like totally different.
Literally separated by an ocean.
Literally separated by an ocean and literally like from two cultures that are not tied in any way. Because I don't think I don't know much about the weeping women in Mexico, but I do know that like it seems to be independently, those stories are independent from the ones from the British Isles.
My only experience and exposure to that is, I'm sure you'll be shocked, Supernatural. Because yeah. There is a Supernatural episode about that.
Yeah. And then also, like, I think that kind of ties into the idea of the sirens from Greek mythology as well. The women who sing and sometimes it's bad. Bad things happen when women sing.
The singing's not bad, just bad things happen.
Right. Yeah. When women sing or when women cry near water, apparently it's bad for everybody else.
Okay, so for my next one, I'm going to take us to a different part of the world.
Yes.
Not too far away, but a different part of the world. And I am going to talk about the Lamia. It's kind of said it's said the same way, but there are some different spellings of it.
I think
an audio is not a visual medium.
It's kind of hard to explain. Yeah, like for example, like why Banshee has different spellings when you're like, oh, no, that's not how it's actually spelled. I get
it. Yeah, just visualize it. So what do you know of this particular fae, this particular spirit?
I actually don't think that I know I know the name and I feel like I should know more about them, but I always think of them as the same thing as kind of like Naga, which are the snake people. And I don't know if that's right or not.
No.
Okay. Then I may be thinking of a completely different like creature then.
There are animals involved, but not snakes.
Okay. Okay.
So just kind of a brief overview. This is a woodland spirit and guardian spirit of orphans in Eastern Baltic mythology.
I must be thinking of an entirely different creature then. And I wonder if that's to do with spelling.
It could be.
Yeah.
Eastern Baltic mythology or Jotvingian mythology, which tied to the old Prussians, and that particular culture contributed to the formation of the Lithuanian state.
Okay. So we're in Lithuania here.
Yeah, we're in Eastern Europe.
Eastern Europe, got it.
So, again, as we talked about earlier, there's so many of these stories that mirror other cultures and other mythologies. So, in a story that mirrors many other gods and goddesses, she was originally a sky spirit, but her compassion for human suffering brought her to Earth to share our fate.
Okay.
So, you see this particular entity very prevalent in mainly two mythologies. Lithuanian and Latvian. And there are some different aspects depending on which culture you're looking at. So in Lithuanian culture, this is actually considered to be like one of the oldest goddesses of Lithuanian mythology. Mm-hmm. Images dating all the way back to the Mesolithic period right after the Ice Age. So we're talking like old.
Okay, yeah.
This one, like we said earlier, we're not talking about things that are pretty and sprightish and have wings and such. Lamias could appear in many forms, most of them animals. So this is my second list for you.
Okay.
So some of the animals that they could appear as: mares, goats, bears, dogs. Sometimes they could have bird claws or feet on a woman, with either the head or lower body of a goat. You take your pick. You can have it either way. A half human, half dog, and half mare, like very similar to like a centaur-like creature.
So there's this is our folklore horse time. Okay.
This is your horse.
This is my horse. I'm ready. I'm ready to learn about a new horse.
You get full horse and you get half horse.
Okay.
So there's options. Sometimes they're only depicted as having one eye, like a cyclops.
Okay.
Let's go back. You know, what were you saying about banshees, that about a lot of the creatures that are from that particular area, especially like female entities?
Mm-hmm.
They got them, those big old hanging titties, right?
Yeah. They talk about their breasts for some reason.
So this particular fey creature, big boobs and rock hard nips. Like, I don't mean like they're erect, like literally they're stone nipples.
That is certain. I'm having a hard time visualizing this creature. Maybe it's just because of the rock nipples. But oh my.
Like many other fae, they could be dangerous to men, and they were fans of a good tickle fight, if you will. They like to tickle and, you know, pinch men to death, and then they would eat them.
Oh, okay.
So in this way, they're very similar to the Lamia in Greek mythology, as far as, you know, wanting to punish men and eat them.
Right, and I think that's where I was thinking is the Lamia from Greek mythology, because mm-hmm. those are snake people, right?
Yes.
Okay, it doesn't matter. It's not important.
They kept huge cows that could be milked by any people that came across them.
Okay.
But when colder weather would hit, those cows would die.
Okay.
And they're very tied to water as well. They could be responsible for hail, storms, or rain. And rainbows were often called a ribbon lost by the Lamias.
Hmm. Okay.
So it's interesting that I feel, what do you think, why do you think that so many of these creatures have ties to water? Do you think it just has to do with kind of the nature of water, as far as it being like an unknown, almost kind of liminal in a way?
I think that would be my initial wondering, is like, why so many of these kind of interesting, like specifically female creatures are tied to water. And I don't know. That is a really great question. It's like, why do we see so many of these like things that are just like, yeah, and they were in the water, or they're near the water, or they're associated with water?
I mean, I think that you could maybe say that a lot of it probably has to do with the nature of the ethereal nature of these creatures being atmospheric, and things that are tied to atmosphere. Like that's why these in particular are tied to like rain and storms and things, if they danced or sang, because they are atmospheric spirits.
Hmm. I mean, there are a lot of like female river spirits and water mm-hmm. spirits. You almost I'm going to make preface there, like in Western culture, you almost always see water spirits tied to female form.
Yeah.
And that's not, I don't believe that's necessarily the case when you look at like Eastern mythology. But it is kind of like why the water is a feminine element.
I guess because it does contain so much life. Like water is this necessary, like you have to have water to live. So.
And then it's tied to the, like typically water tied to the moon in a lot of ways too. You see that element, like the tides and that sort of thing. So and that's considered, typically most moon spirits are also female. I don't know if you can tie this in there. This is just I'm throwing this out here.
No, you actually bring up a really good point. In some stories in like the Lithuanian mythology of this particular entity, there are stories of it, like not stories of it as like a fae creature, but more of just a full-on goddess, mm-hmm. where it did fall in love with the moon. Because in this mythology, the moon is portrayed as having a male aspect and not female. Okay. Yeah.
I know very little about
I know very little about the moon.
That too, but.
So if this creature were to have a personal ad, it would say things like, loves kids, respects a good work ethic,
mm-hmm.
loves to volunteer, you know, i.e. helping those that are in need, and they don't want no scrubs. They would specifically punish and ridicule the lazy. So I would actually like to, because we do get into a lot of, you know, you were saying earlier that you have with like the Seelie court and the Unseelie court, like we have mm-hmm. the fae that are helpful, and we have the ones that are a bit more mischievous and a little bit darker. And I think that in Western portrayals, like especially like in modern cultures, it's either one or the other. We don't have a whole lot, I think, in really popular representations that kind of straddle the line between the two. And this mm-hmm. is actually a really good one that does kind of bridge those two things. And I actually would like to read a small little folktale that has to do with this one, especially when it comes to children, because, you know, a lot of the times whenever we're talking about fae and babies and children, we're talking about some baby snatching happening. It's not really anything good that's going on. So this is actually a particular one that has to do with babies. A woman was harvesting a flower bed and had taken her child with her. She was so busy with her work that the child slept the day through and she left the little one behind. The woman went home at the end of the day to milk the cows and make dinner. She served her husband, who asked her, "Where's my son?" With terror, she whispered, "I've forgotten him." She ran as fast as she could to the place in which she left her son, hearing a llama speak, "Forgotten child." The mother from the distance asked the llama for her child back. The fairy said, come, dear woman, take your child. We have done nothing to him. We know that you worked very hard at many jobs and that you didn't want to leave your child behind. The fairies then went on to shower the babe with much treasure, enough gifts to raise several children upon. The mother went home with her precious baby, and with her gifts, she was greeted with great joy. Another woman, hearing of her good fortune, was taken over by jealousy. She took to thinking, "I shall do the same as her and also be showered in gifts." The next evening at dusk, she took her child, left him in the fields, and went home. She ate dinner thoughtlessly before pausing to think of her child and the treasure. When she approached the field, she heard the fairies say, "You left your child in greed." And the child screamed with such great pain, for he was pinched and tortured mercilessly. They continued their torture until the mother came. The fairies tossed the child at her feet. The babe was dead. So I love that with this one, you get both aspects of it. And it really does have to work. Like, it has to do with who you are as a person. Like, again, they love a good work ethic. They love people who put in the work.
Yeah, and that's an interesting variation of a story that you hear a whole lot, is that someone does something either by accident or this fortune falls upon them, and then another person comes along and tries to milk that for greed and misfortune falls upon them. But with babies, man, that's rough.
Yeah. Like, that's a hard lesson to learn. Mm-hmm. They also are depicted sometimes as foretelling a newborn's future, which, like, when I read that, the immediate thing I thought about was Sleeping Beauty and how, you know, the three fairies, like, were bestowing gifts upon her. So that's in Lithuanian mythology. In Latvian mythology, it's not as kind of broad as in the Lithuanian tradition, mainly depicted as an assistant at birth, assuring the health and welfare of both the mother and the child. And if the mother doesn't make it, boom, you literally have a fairy godmother. That is what they do. They become like a foster parent for you going forward. Like, it is, I'm like, oh, okay. So, like, you don't hear a whole lot of, like, non-Cinderella type stuff where it is like actual fairy godmother, but in this case, it is a fairy godmother.
That's the most wholesome thing, I think.
But that's the thing, is that since she can't have children of her own and she's taking care of these, you know, motherless children, eventually her image is degraded and she's accused of that old Faye Chesna of baby snatching by disrespectful husbands. This wears and actually changes the aspect of this entity. Like, looks and sweetness are lost, and she does become an evil hag, but weeps at her fate, hoping that she can return to her beautiful self.
That's an interesting thing. How does that become part of the story, where she is accused of this thing, so she becomes this thing outwardly or inwardly, and then because of the accusations, she wants to be her former self. Now, would that rely on believers changing their perspective of her?
That's interesting.
How does that go? How does that work?
Exactly. Like, what is the... It makes me think of Tinkerbell and the whole, like, I do believe in fairies. Yeah. Like, how much, like, our perception impacts those things, possibly.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to think about that particular aspect of her, because it does feel like if you believe hard enough, maybe she'll be pretty again, or, you know. I can fix her, like, less of a hag. And it's also that it's specifically this idea of the husband's changing her identity to a hag. I have questions how that works, but it's an interesting kind of concept.
Yeah, but that is a good primer for the Lamia.
Yeah, the Balkans are weird. They have a lot of weird mythological things in there that would be very fun to explore later.
And almost always, like, you know, in the tale, you know, with the two women and their babes, like, I feel like almost always it's a morality tale as well. Mm-hmm. It's always stories about, like, don't be an asshole. Don't, you know, work hard and good things will come to you.
Yeah. All these stories are really just like, if you're nice, sometimes the fairies are nice to you, but make sure you're following a bunch of arbitrary rules too while you're at it. But if you're bad, then they're going to get you. They know. They know. It doesn't matter.
So what did you have to round us out with?
So for our last little bit of fae folklore, I kind of wanted to go through something a little darker. And I would say this might be a little lesser known.
Pinching babies to death is not dark enough for you.
It's pretty dark, but they also help in childbirth. So you've got some duality spirits going on there. Whereas I was like, let's go dark for this one. Are you familiar at all with the concept of the slua?
I am not.
Okay. So this is one of my, I say, like, I've always been really fascinated by the concept of them. And I first was introduced to them through fairy smut, weirdly enough, and then did some research later. But the slua are actually not, it's not one type of fairy. It is a collection of fae. And this is kind of breaking us back to the British Isles with this one. And it's bringing us back to the idea where pre-Christian tradition meets Christian kind of like conversion. So I've always really been fascinated by this because we don't necessarily know where the concept came from, because we're very only familiar with the post-Christian traditions of this. So let's talk about the slua. And I think I'm pronouncing this right, because I grew up and I always thought it was called like the slua, which sounds like coleslaw, and that's
like coleslaw.
Yeah, it's not correct at all. Like, I'm not pronouncing anything correctly. The slua. And the slua are also known as the fairy host. And they are, of course, attributed to the Unseelie court, which, again, court can refer to royalty, or it can refer to a retinue or a troop of fae. So in this case, it largely refers to a troop of fae, troop of fairies. They're considered some of the scariest of all of the fairies, especially the trooping fairies, due to kind of like how unstoppable they are. You can't really do anything if the slua are after you. And that's why they're kind of talked about in hushed whispers, and kind of their stories kind of grew with this kind of fear of the dark. And so this is going into some of the primal of humanity, fears of the dark.
Okay.
Yeah. So according to Lewis Spencer, who was like a 19th century folklorist, they were the souls of the unforgiven dead. So, of course, you can see this Christian kind of undercurrent there. Or, of course, the spirits of mortals who have passed away and died. And while you have certain interpretations of it, I think it was Wilde who said that, like, who was very clear on being like, some of them may be the unforgiven dead, the souls of mortals, but there has to be another component. There has to be the corporeal, which may be the fae, and then the incorporeal, which are the spirits who can't really touch anything but a part of them. So these are these spirits that are known for flying through the air. And specifically, one of the ways that they are kind of talked about and discussed is as if they were a flock of starlings. If you ever think about starlings, they are really fascinating if you've ever seen any videos of them, where they can all move in formation and duck and weave.
They're just like a mass.
A mass of birds that move almost like identically in the way they move. It's really cool to watch them. So that's how they're kind of described in a lot of these old stories. They move together. There's also the account that they might have been the spirits of fallen angels, which is an interesting concept, because a lot of theorists and religious scholars have been like, that doesn't quite make sense, because we know that fallen angels didn't turn into this, blah, blah, blah. Like, there's a lot of theology involved there. So there's different accounts of their origins to kind of give you an idea. And again, according, everything that we know comes from the pre-Christian, the post-Christian tradition. So we don't have a lot of information about pre-Christian origin of the slua. We know that they were there. So they are a mass of fae creatures that fly, like, the quote is like, in great clouds. So like a birds, like starlings specifically, or even a bunch of insects like locusts. And they will swoop down and abduct humans, and they will a lot of times carry them off. So physically they can disappear entirely. And if they disappear entirely, they can be forced to participate in the host's activities. So the host can make you do things like kill people or attack other people or become like almost like a wild thing, right?
So is this like kind of like a possession type thing?
The language makes you think that it might be that you are sort of possessed by, like, you are not physically possessed, but they torment you into doing, like, you are physically and emotionally manipulated into doing these things.
Okay.
It's a really great question because I also wonder about this. However,
Because
some
if
people
that's the case, like that is definitely Christian influence on it. So
feels like a very Christian influence is like that you are tormented by fey creatures into doing this thing, right? However, sometimes they just carry you off several miles away and then you are returned to where you were before, or you're just discovered in a random location. Like you have traveled miles and miles and then you just show up someplace. But the people who are carried off by the Slua are never returned unscathed. They either have like changes in personality or they're very different after being abducted. So I think you're picking up on some of the themes here for what you're seeing in people, right? They may also steal your livestock and other property. There's different accounts on how they might be poisonous, like either breathing on you could be poisonous, so they could kill your livestock, or they may shoot you with a tiny dart that will poison people in their path, so you could die through poisoning in this kind of
okay.
concept too. Yeah, it's like there's a lot that they attribute to the Slua. Obviously, they tend to be active only at night, and
Of course.
during the day, they're said to hide in kind of almost like creepy places. Are there some old ruins next to your house? Some caves? There might be some Slua hiding during the day there. Like, don't go there. They're definitely boogeymen. Like, and I find that really interesting too, is that there's this like, very much this idea of the boogeyman that come out only at night to do this. Other stories, instead of affecting you physically, they may greedily devour the souls of the dead. So in this case, when a person is dying or thought to be dying, they will swoop in the last minute and steal that person's soul. So they cannot ascend, they cannot become, like, you know, they cannot go to heaven. They cannot have anything happen to them because their soul will be stolen and devoured, it seems like, according to the stories. Like you don't become one of them that way, but they
That's what I was going to
devour
ask.
you. Yeah,
Yeah.
it seems like they just like take you in and you are gone. And if that happens, they only come in through west-facing windows. And that's a really interesting piece of folklore that I'm not really sure the reason. So the west is very much attributed to them. And to avoid that happening, you need to obstruct west-facing windows when someone in your house is about to die. It's so specific, right? It's so specific. So the Slua have been around for a long time. There's a lot of people that write about them. Like you saw Lady Wilde talks about them and her stuff. So they've been around for a while, but we don't really know much about them in like pre-Christian times. So I find them like fascinating because they'll come in right before you can give the last rites, which is a Christian tradition, of course, when you give the last rites, so someone's soul can they can have peace on earth and they can go to heaven, right? That is why like a lot of times like west side of houses are kept closed for tradition for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It sounds like a kind of an amalgam of a bunch of different creatures or a bunch of different entities.
It really does, because a lot of people attribute them to the Wild Hunt. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
Yeah.
And you see that more in modern interpretations of them, but that's not really what they are, because the Wild Hunt can come from a bunch of different sources. Like, for example, when I'm talking about the Wild Hunt can be, I have to go back here because I didn't make notes about this. The Wild Hunt is basically a chase that it is led by a mythological figure. And there is a, in today's kind of popular culture and some like fiction stories with these, they attribute the two as being one and the same. But the Wild Hunt is usually led by one figure. And in like a lot of legends, it's even been Odin. You see a lot of Odin leading it. And because there's a really famous painting called The Wild Hunt of Odin that's from the 1800s that shows just that. But it's not the same thing as the Slua, because the Slua are like characterized as being wild and untamed, and they come out at night. Whereas the Wild Hunt is really like a folklore motif. And you see that largely over like Northern European cultures. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So like the Slua are really just kind of, there's not really any kind of intelligence there. It's just like a hunger. Like it.
Like it feels like a force and a hunger that comes in and is always malicious. Whereas a Wild Hunt is more of this idea of one leader figure that is bringing you through, like is led by a bunch of other supernatural figures in the chase and the pursuit of certain prey.
Right.
And that has been used to talk about humans, but it also has been used to talk about other animals in kind of like different folklore. For example, like the one that's mostly considered is a Welsh mythological figure who is kind of the king of the Tylwyth Teg from, and again, I can't pronounce anything. I'm going to try to pronounce his name, and I've never been able to do it successfully. So Gwynab Nudd, I wish that I could pronounce Welsh things. I'm so sorry. I'm trying so hard. But he is the ruler of the Welsh underworld. And he is often considered one of the leaders of the Wild Hunt as well. But in modern times, the two, I feel, have been transposed on each other.
Mm-hmm.
That you have this idea that the Wild Hunt and the Slua are the same thing, and they're not. So I'm just basically giving you some...
It's interesting to me that for, you know, a creature that, you know, has been heavily, heavily influenced by, you know, conversion into...
Mm-hmm.
Had a sheen of Christianity put on it, if you will, that mm-hmm. there's not some sort of, like... story attached to it where, oh, it only attacks you if you know certain people, like if you're wicked or if you do this particular thing. It sounds like that it's just it can happen to anyone, that it,
yeah,
there's no rhyme or reason to it.
And that seems to be the underlying source of this. So by that understanding, is being chased as a human, if you are a human after dark and you are being chased by this thing, I understand why the association with the Wild Hunt became a thing, but I haven't been able to find a source or anything that links the two other than just random people kind of online talking about it. That, oh, the Wild Hunt in this like folklore tradition sounds like the Slua hunting humans, and it doesn't feel like the same thing. So, and like there's some thought to be like the Slua are of course the unrestful dead. So they are of course evil souls. If you are a good soul, you don't become this amalgamation, this force. But that doesn't vibe really with the Wild Hunt that has a leader who can be anything from, like, again, the Wild Hunt could be led by anybody. Like in folklore, it's led by like King Arthur sometimes, or Herne the Hunter. Like there's a lot of different figures in folklore that lead the Wild Hunt. And while they are like not necessarily like always morally good, they're usually either morally gray or aligned in some way with nature specifically.
There's some sort of justice element to it.
Yeah. Or the hunt is usually just like the hind, like the stag that they all like hunt or something like that. It doesn't have to necessarily be a human.
Right.
So I think it's interesting that these two things are often interchanged together when the Slua are so much more scary than like an organized hunt the way we know it. So yeah, that is one of my favorite kind of folklore stories that I think gets overlooked a lot in terms of like other creatures that are scary.
Yeah, that's a darkness that's going to eat your soul. That's pretty mm-hmm. fucking scary. Mm-hmm.
Flying like starlings, specifically like starlings, which again, if you've never watched starlings move at night.
It's quite gorgeous.
Yeah, and they are birds that move at a certain time of the day, because don't starlings move like at dusk and dawn?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that their thing as well? So it's interesting to hear them described specifically as this type of bird. So I think it's safe to say that fairies are a lot more complicated than Tinkerbell that we see. And I think that a lot of our modern understanding of fairies for a long time was because of J.M. Barrie and Peter Pan. Like, I think we all got into this idea of this is what they were like, and it makes them a lot less scary. And I think if we really look at them, they become a lot more scary long term. And that's a lot of fun for me anyway, to kind of like take a look at these things. And it's also what makes these kind of creatures so fascinating for us to learn about all these years later.
Yeah, like there's that it's been heavily sanitized, mm-hmm. you know, and now we're getting back to kind of, and I think it's very interesting, totally a topic for another day, but how in our modern world, we're starting to look into a lot of the older traditions and try to reclaim some of that just because of the world we live in, to have that connection.
Oh,
and like, I think it's worthwhile because, yes, positive things are good, but being able to kind of study the darker elements of our mythologies and our our histories as a culture is, you gotta have the dark to know about the positive stuff too.
Yeah, definitely. I think if we take into consideration how complex a lot of these creatures and these myths are, it's a little easier to look at the world right now and all its complexities. And this is kind of a small glimpse of that. I've just been thinking a lot. It's 2024. There's a lot going on. it's hard not to put it in that context.
Yeah.
But overall, well,
you can't have depth without shadow.
Absolutely. I think that's the best way of looking at it. And there are a few things more shadowed than fairy folklore.
Oh.
Well, friends, we've talked about some fairies. I have had a couple glasses of wine, and I think that sets us up for this episode.
Yes, yes. As always, we would love to hear from you. What are your favorite fairies? Are there any particular fairies you'd like for us to talk about? Do you believe in fairies?
Clap your hands 3 times. No, don't do that.
Yeah, no, go ahead. Yeah, we can hear you. But
if you want to, that's fine. Yeah, have a good time. Live your best life.
And if you could, please rate and review us wherever you listen to your podcasts. On Apple Music, Apple Podcast. I don't know what they call it these days.
I know you're so tired of hearing about it. And I know that you're so tired of hearing us talk about it. But that is the creator's life this way. That is the grind. Is that, like, tell us you like us and we'll make more of
it. Tell us we're pretty. Tell us you like us.
No, but until next time, stay safe. Close your west-facing windows and make sure those windows are small enough that the Lamia can't come in and grab you in the middle of the night.
Yes, yes. Be on the lookout. Listen for Black Annis.
Mm-hmm.
Culture Cryptids is recorded, produced, and engineered by me, JD.
And me, Corey. You can find us on social media at Culture Cryptids on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
Questions, comments, corrections, hate mail? Email us at culturecryptids@gmail.com. We'll see you next time. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of Knox Pride.